Back at Club 30, I'm Henrik Lundqvist, your host, sitting here with my buddy Jay.
Hey guys, welcome back. I'm excited to be here.
Another week, new opportunities here, and this is definitely an episode of Opportunity to Learn. We're talking to JJ Redick.
What you said about the reason to get up in the morning, it's not hyperbolic, because I did feel like part of it was like it gave me a purpose, and I think that was the tough part at Duke, and it was still is to a degree the tough part about retiring. When something is your purpose, it becomes your identity and it becomes a part of your ego structure. And then every athlete, you know, not to be morbid, but every athlete has to die twice, right? There's the retirement, you die. Like a part of you dies. And letting go of that, oh, it's hard, man. It was hard. I knew it was the right thing, but it was hard.
There's a million basketball podcasts to listen to. The reason I listened to his is because you can tell he cares so much. And I think what came out in this interview with JJ is how much he cares about basketball as a player or in media or as a, what he says, as a steward of the game. I think that what I got from this conversation is that he lives and breathes this game and he can't live without it.
Here's JJ Redick. He played 15 seasons in the NBA, was one of the most decorated Duke players of all time. You might have heard his podcast, The Old Man and the Three. We're opening up the doors at Club 30 for JJ Redick. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on. First of all, I'm very impressed just by the setup, the aesthetics in here.
You like
this
it?
Yeah, this is a place I'd like to hang out.
Yeah, that was the goal, right?
That was the idea.
You guys nailed it.
That would feel good. Listen, we have a lot to cover today, but I want to start with New York City, Brooklyn. You live in Brooklyn. How long have you been there?
We've been in Brooklyn 6 years. We were in Dumbo for five of those, and we've been in Cobble Hill now for about 9 months. We are masochists, and we decided after doing an apartment renovation that we'd now like to do a brownstone renovation. So we're like halfway through that. Honestly, we love living in New York City. Because I played, we lived all over the country. And when I played, we always wanted to have sort of a home base, you know, a place, because you move around a lot, you get traded, you become free agent, whatever. We wanted to kind of feel settled. My wife's twin sister moved up here to work in PR 11 years ago. Huh. And after starting having kids, we just realized we wanted to be, you know, close to her. I'm very tight with her. She's one of my best friends. She's my best friend. And my wife and her twins, obviously, they spent all this time together. And because we've lived all over, we've kind of seen a lot of America. We've seen a lot of different communities. And I have to say, like, living in New York is just, it's special. And we were able to build a network of people and community of friends here quicker than anywhere else we lived. New Orleans was up there too, but like, it just was, is very easy in that regard, which was really helpful for the place we were in our lives having young kids.
Yeah. So I spent the past 17 years in Manhattan. And I have a really tough time leaving the island. I have friends that moved over to Brooklyn and they love it. But can you tell me what's the best part about living in Brooklyn?
I love when people say this, because it's like, dude, there's like a bridge and it's like 200 feet long.
Yeah. Like, you don't need your passport to go to Brooklyn.
I know.
10
but
minutes
it,
away.
It feels like a very big step for me when people say, you should come out and try Brooklyn. It's like,
oh my gosh.
But no, but seriously,
First of all, you get access to Manhattan.
Yeah,
you know, I do a lot of work at Seaport for ESPN. It's a quick 10-minute commute for me, so that's nice. If I want to get into the West Village for dinner or something like that, it's very easy. It's a little quieter. Cobble Hill in particular is just a quiet neighborhood with access to Court Street and Smith Street, which have restaurants and shops and all the stuff you need in a city. There's good schools. I don't know. It feels a little bit less. When my wife's sister, twin sister, moved up here in 2012, we rented that summer in Soho, thinking, hey,
no, this
maybe
is the place.
New York can be the home base, right? And it's just a little overwhelming, you know? It was a little overwhelming. That's all. I don't want to wait 15 minutes for an Uber that's three blocks away. You know what I mean? It's just the tourist traffic, all that stuff. So it just feels a little different over there.
Jay, I think we should go out there and tourists a little bit, just to see what it's all about.
I've been to Cobble Hill a lot, Hank.
Okay.
Have
you spent any time in Brooklyn Bridge Park, by the way?
I crossed the bridge a few times.
No, Brooklyn Bridge Park.
Have been to Brooklyn Bridge Park?
There's a carousel for the girls.
Oh, it's amazing.
Huge promenade. It's amazing. Great pizza.
There's all these piers. There's there's like a Central Park-esque pier. There's basketball courts. There's soccer fields. There's beach volleyball.
I might have been there.
Okay.
Maybe.
By the way, because we're on this topic, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Okay, because part of the reason I came on the podcast is because you're a New York legend. And I always have been filled with this sort of like deep-seated, not envy or jealousy, and it's really not regret because I never really had the option to come here and play, but I've always wondered what it would be like to be a New York Knick and play in the Garden. And now I have two very close friends, Josh Hart and Jalen Brunson, that are on the team. So I go to their games. I'm a little jealous of them.
Yeah.
And Josh in particular, you know, he's like came midseason and now he's become a fan favorite. What is it like? I mean, what is it like?
I think the beauty of it is you play in a place where people care so much, but then you walk two blocks from the Garden and you can kind of disappear a little bit. There's so much going on in the city and people are busy. And so I feel like even if you're a star for the Knicks or the Rangers, there's a way of living a pretty normal life, but still feel the hype. And to me, it was such a, you know, it was such a cool thing to play for an organization where you had a fan base that cared so much. You know, you look around the league and yeah, I would say fans care, but there's a big difference between different markets, right? And in the end, you want to come to work and feel like it really matters every day to people. And also then you have Madison Square Garden.
Right.
I mean, it's just such a cool place. There's so much stuff going on there. And something that I explore even more now after I retired. I have more time to be there for different events.
It's interesting you talk about the fan experience and how that sort of meant so much to you, because I commuted down to Philly my 2 years, and it was not by choice. I did not want to do this, but because of the one-year contracts, because my kids had just gotten into a school in Brooklyn, we felt it was the best thing for the family. So I sucked it up and did the 4 hours a day on the New Jersey Turnpike. Not ideal. But I loved playing there because of the fans. They cared so much, and I will take, even if it's derangement at times, right, and delusion, but the passion is like, I'll take that over apathy, and I enjoyed that experience so much. And it was because the fans cared.
I mean, playing against the Flyers for 15 years, those fans can be pretty ruthless.
Yeah.
So, but your experience playing for the 76ers, you would say that was a great experience then.
It was generally very positive, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I got booed myself as a home player a few times, which was a new experience. But I'll take it, because I the rest of the stuff that comes with that passion and that engagement is so good as a player.
Huh. So you play 15 years in the NBA and five different teams.
Six
different teams.
Yeah, I got traded twice. And I spent 2 months in Milwaukee and 2 months in Dallas. So.
And before NBA, you had an incredible college career. At Duke, where your number four is retired. How was your time at Duke? I want to get into this with college sports, because in Sweden, we don't have college sports. It's fascinating to me that you're a big star. You play in front of thousands of people on weekends, and then on Monday morning, you sit in class. That's just fascinating to me. Can we talk about, I want to hear about your time at Duke, but also being a star in college.
I grew up a Duke fan. So I grew up in Virginia, and that's ACC country, you know, so it's UVA, Duke, NC State, Wake Forest. There's another school in Chapel Hill. I'm forgetting the name. UNC. No, just kidding. I knew you wouldn't get that. No, but there's all these schools within 2.5 hours. And so I grew up watching more college basketball than I did NBA, and I became a fan of Duke. So it was a lifetime dream to play at Duke. The experience initially was not what I expected, because it was harder. Everything was harder. School was harder. Social life was harder. Practices were harder. Players were better. And then the season started. The pressure was more. I was 17 my senior year. I just turned 18 going to my freshman year. I was not prepared mentally or socially or emotionally for any of that. So I had a really rough time my first couple years, with some great help from Coach K and a therapist and Dr. Brody, who oversaw the psychiatry program at Duke Med, and it was just, he's a Duke legend. Spent the summer just talking with them, and
It was, this was after what,
this
what
was my sophomore year. Sophomore year. So this, and it was like a life changing experience, and it helped me become the person I am. It helped become the player I am. I learned so much about myself, but I also continue to do therapy off and on. You know, when I felt like I needed check ins and I needed self improvement for, you know, the next 17 years now. The experience was great in terms of growth. The basketball side of it, playing for Coach K, was better than I could have ever expected. I mean, my dad is right here, you know, in terms of like my heroes and my idols. And then it's like Coach K is right under him. He's a great, great man. And we became friends by the end of that 4 years. But I would say this, it was way harder. Everything about it was way harder than I expected. And it was a mental fuck every day. It was like between school, expectations, pressure, Coach K, you know, he's got a military background. It was just hard. And I got to the NBA and I was like, oh shit, this is easy. not playing the games, right. But just like your day-to-day life is so much different than college.
Like, when did you think, like, okay, school's over here. When did you switch gears to hockey? Like, at what age would you do that?
Well, after high school, I turned pro in Sweden. There's definitely Swedes that decided to go to college instead, to come over to the States and try that. But for most players overseas, they turn pro, local teams, local league, and eventually, if they're good enough, they make the move to the NHL. My sister, actually, she moved to play tennis in college in the States. So she had that experience. But it always fascinated me with the big stars, because basketball, football, it's so big here at college sports. So can you just go through, I want to hear just the feeling of this, you have a massive game on the Saturday and then Monday morning, I try to wrap my head around that. You sit in class and a lot of these students, I'm sure they're at the game. And is it hard to come down and like,
you know,
humble yourself?
There was also stuff that happens between the game and Monday morning, right? You have to be a college kid. You know, you have to enjoy it a little bit. And socially, I was very active. I would say I was very active my first couple years. And then I got more serious just about like regiment and discipline and sleep and eating right. And like picking and choosing my spots. You know, if it was a Saturday night, we had a game and I knew Sunday was off, I'm going to go to Shooters. It was a country western bar. It was the local hangout spot. There was a mechanical bull. You know, you'd go and have some drinks and have a good time. Like, it wasn't anything. But then you come back to class on Monday, and there were definitely times where classmates are asking for an autograph or a picture, or your professors or, you know, I had professors literally run the gamut between like, I don't want athletes in my class because you're all stupid, to like, I'll give you a little extra favoritism because you're an athlete. Like, I got both of it.
You got both.
Yeah. Not anything where like people weren't fixing my grades, but you know, they recognize, hey, you had two road games this week. You have a term paper due next week. Guess what? I'll give you 3 extra days to do it. Stuff like that.
Yeah.
That was helpful.
It's a lot of fans that had opinions about you.
Yeah.
And not always positive.
Mostly negative.
Mostly negative. Like, how was that to handle? Mentally, was that hard? Or was that something that got you going?
Yeah, I mean,
excited?
Look, I go back to what I said earlier. You grow up and you want something so bad. And I really did. I wanted to play at Duke so bad. And you get there and your expectations are not the same as the reality. It fucks you up a little bit. And particularly with the sort of animosity, you know, my first 10, 11 games my freshman year, we either played in Cameron at home or we played on a neutral site against like a nationally ranked team. So we would go to Indiana, played UCLA. We did Ohio State and Greensboro. I think we came up here because I think once a year we would come up here and play in the Garden or play in the Meadowlands. And it was like right after Christmas break, we go to Clemson, my first real road game. We come out for warmups and the entire student section is chanting terrible things about me, you know, yelling at me, screaming at me. And I was just like, oh, this is different. And I kind of just like was like, all right, I'm just going to kind of embrace it. But then it just got to the point, you know, when you stay in college, people just hate you more and more. There's like an exponential growth factor or something. I don't know what it is. And so by midway through my second year, I was just like, Jesus, man, this is this is too much for me. And I self-medicated, you know, I was a party animal. I would be late to practice it. It was bad. And it wasn't even that I was rebelling. It was just like, I am not emotionally equipped to deal with what feels like everyone hating me. You know what I mean? It was a weird feeling.
This is before social media.
I couldn't even imagine. Right. It wasn't like I could go on Twitter. This was like things said, you know how the people talk about keyboard warriors, you know, where they're like, you would never say that to my face. Well, no, people said it to my face. People talked about my mom. People talked about all, you know, I had acne on my shoulders in my first 2 years in college. And like people pointed that out. People would dress up. They wear mock Duke No. 4 jerseys and then paint red dots on their shoulders. And like, I'm 19 years old. I emotionally, like, how do you get into that? I used to get phone calls. A group of Maryland fans kept getting my number. I changed my number so many times. I'm getting calls, 15, 20 calls every night for weeks at like 2, 3, 4 in the morning. People telling me I'm the Antichrist. I mean, it was just shit like that. And so, again, that's a big reason that therapy was so important for me, just to help me feel just comfortable with who I was. Like, just embrace, like, I am who I am. And, you know, I don't know, it was very important to my life. I'm glad it happened, to be honest with you. I'm glad it happened.
You would say there's a silver lining in all that, that you learned and it kind of prepared you for your MBA career, would you say?
Well,
that?
I definitely did, because it was the first time that I'd really experienced adversity. And we think I broke my wrist I remember giving a speech, actually. I think it was my senior year early when I was at Duke, and I went and spoke to a boys and girls club. And they wanted me to talk about adversity. I'm like, adversity? Like, I broke my wrist a few times. That's the only thing I had to talk about. You know what I mean? And so how do we grow as human beings? How do you grow as a player unless you fail first? So, you know, I coach my kids now, and like, that's a big thing I tell them all the time. We will do drills or something. I'm like, no, you got to keep doing it even if you're failing. My 6-year-old, he's fucking all the time. Like, I'm not good at that. Can't make a corner jumper. I'm like, well, you'll never be able to make a corner jumper if you don't keep trying. So like, failure is good. And I think I was so afraid of failure when I got to Duke that I learned to embrace it. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Is there examples that you can think of in your career where you look back and you're like, oh, that failure was actually really important to my growth in my career?
Well, I definitely had setbacks where I always talk about assessment. How do I assess my own game and try to be as honest as possible? And that's really when I learned something about myself, but also realized what I have to work on to get better. But I remember at 18, 19, I was about to turn pro and I was tasting it and they sent me down. That was the first time I really questioning, should I be playing hockey? Like, because I was there and then I was not. So I had to dig deep. And I realized I didn't have to dig for long. I'm like, of course I want to play hockey. I love it so much. I just have to work harder. I have to be better. And I will get another opportunity. And I did.
But the thing you just said about getting sent back and like questioning, right? There's probably moments that every athlete sort of questions. I mean, there's people that lack any self-awareness. They never question. It's a delusional confidence or irrational confidence, right? But I do think for professional sports, talent is a necessity. Some sort of talent, whether it's a team sport, individual sport, you have to have some sort of talent, something that separates you, something that adds value. Beyond that, I think professional sports weeds out the people that can't deal with adversity, because it's inevitable. It's inevitable. And I'm sure, I know you had an illustrious, great career. I'm sure there were times where the New York media, you had a bad game, you had a bad stretch, the New York media got on you. Hey, that's a level of adversity. Being able to be mentally clear enough to go out there the next game and get 38 saves, right? That's what weeds people out.
And I think it comes down to also passion for the game. Because if you have that, you will overcome that. But if you don't love the game that much, I think, and that starts to happen already at 16, 17, you see guys, it suddenly starts to become a lot harder. If you don't really have that passion, that drive, it's going to be very hard to overcome. So some people think for professional athletes, yeah, it's always a straight line. No, there's so many setbacks. No. There's so many losses and tough moments. But at least for me, I kept coming back to that love for the game that helped me. Okay, you know what? I'm going to work even harder and try to overcome this. But you definitely saw, you know, at age 10, there's a bunch of players. I thought, these guys, they're going to be the best. But then at 15, 16, they start to, you know, slide a little bit because they didn't really have that passion and it was hard for them to deal with the adversity.
Yeah, that's beautifully said. It really is. The sophomore year thing, I called my sisters. I have older twin sisters. I called them. They came over to campus and I told them I wanted to quit and they talked me out of it. And when I look back, and I knew this within 6 months, but when I look back at the time, the reason I couldn't quit, I can't quit the game. I love it too much. I love basketball too much. I mean, I love my children. I love my wife. I love my brothers and sisters and my friend. Like, I love, like, but there's something, basketball has its own little separate place for me. You know what I mean by that?
So when you played at college, how much are you thinking about NBA at that point?
Not a lot.
Not a lot.
Not a lot. I didn't really think about the NBA till the end of my junior year. Again, it was a different era. There wasn't the one and done stuff where you go to college for a year and then you bounce. So when I started at Duke, I was like, I'm going to be here 4 years. And like, I had personal goals in mind. I had team goals in mind. And one of them was, I want to get my jersey retired. I know I have to graduate. I know I have to be National Player of the Year. All right, this is a 4-year process. So there was never any thought. And then at the end of my junior year, after this, you know, tumultuous first 2 years, junior year, I got the Rupp National Player of the Year, was first team All-American, ACC Player of the Year. And I remember being at the Wooden Award ceremony in LA, and a couple of my friends that were also finalists with me were meeting with NBA agents. And like, one of them invited me to lunch with this agent, and I went, and then I went back to my room and my dad was there, and I was like, should I be talking to agents? Like, should I be thinking of, I was like, that's how I took Italian my junior year, because I was like, hey, it'd be cool if I could go to Europe and play ball overseas. Like, it wasn't really on my radar.
And I think that's so important, not to get ahead of yourself, right? You stay in the moment and you know, step by step, you're getting closer. But you also see that with younger players, sometimes they get ahead of themselves a little bit and they're already there. They arrived already, but they still have some work to do, right?
At least on paper, or at least to their persona, they've arrived. Yeah. I'm not sure if they're mentally prepared for it.
Exactly.
I caught a little bit of First Take this morning, not all of it. And you and Stephen A. were talking about Kawhi Leonard.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a question for both of you, which is, like, what should be the reasonable expectation of the pro athlete today? Certainly it isn't to bear everything and shoulder the entire burden of a franchise. But what I heard was a conflation of availability and reliability from a pro athlete who signs a big contract, a superstar.
Yeah.
And what we as fans and the paying public and the media should expect out of them, other than their performance on the ice or the court.
Yeah.
And made me think of it, because when you're talking about, like, enduring that kind of verbal, mental abuse, like, there's a lot that we don't see as fans on TV. Like, I don't know what Kawhi's going through. Well, now I know he has a torn meniscus. But, like these guys and you guys go through so much physically, mentally, and all we see is the stat line and the media commentary. Like, what is the reasonable expectation of a pro athlete today?
Well, I think, to me, the bigger contract, the bigger responsibility. If an organization invests in you, yeah, of course, you're expected to perform on the court, on the ice. But I think you also have to expect that the organization wants something away from that as well. Because I'm sure the agent will use it negotiating the contract.
Sure.
That, you know, this guy has these numbers, but he also brings ticket sales, jersey sales. And for all that to happen, I think, yeah, it's more than just being on the court or on the ice. To me, if it's the big guys.
Yeah. JJ.
Yeah, you know, in that point, Stephen A. talked about Kawhi and just how really little he does outside of what is required by contract. Huh. Meaning, hey, Kawhi, you have to talk to the press today. You know, okay, I'll go do the cut press. Like, I think in Kawhi's case, he's just... that's not who he is. He's not someone who's going to talk about himself. He doesn't really want to talk. He's not comfortable talking. And how do you fault a guy for his mindset and his person? Like, I don't find fault in it. on a macro level to your question, though.
Yeah.
Sports work best when the players take responsibility for what they're supposed to take for. They provide a product. They provide entertainment. They show they care. The media tells the stories the right way and cover the games the right way. The fans follow along with the media. They're entertained. They get the interaction. And it's like this perfect little balance of all three.
Yeah.
We're so far out of whack in 2023. We're so... It's not working. It feels like we're looking for the... We've got this like industrial complex about the hot take culture. And it has created a rift now with the fans. It's created a rift with the media and the players. And it feels like everybody's just sort of screaming at each other. That's how it feels in my day-to-day life. And I think the athlete, if you ask me, what is the responsibility? The responsibility of the athlete is to be a professional. What does being a professional mean? It means you do your work, right? And by the way, that doesn't mean showing up to the game. Like, I can name some players right now. You know their names who think being a professional athlete means showing up to the game. No. It means treatment, cold tubs, sleep, diet, weightlifting, extra shots before practice, extra shots after practice. Hey, maybe if you've shot 60% from the free throw line for the last 2 weeks, come late and get 100 free throws in at night. That's what it means. And that's not to do once. That's to do every single day over and over, even in the off season. That's why we are paid. We are paid to perform at the highest level. And so I have no sympathy. I don't, for guys that don't do that. I didn't as a teammate, and I certainly don't now as a commentator on this shit. I don't. That is your job, okay? Fans' jobs, to watch, buy a ticket, go cheer, go have some fun with the opposing team. Don't cross a line. Media's job, cover the games, tell the stories, ask the right questions. Try to study the game in a way that is meaningful. We all have so much information right now. Quick Google search. Don't be an idiot. Don't be an idiot. Be educated. Make all that work together.
Yeah. Do you feel like that's the case sometimes, that they're not doing their homework, media?
I had a reporter once ask me. He said, it was my first year in Philly, and he took me aside. We were in Denver after shoot around to do a little profile on me, and he asked me about, you seem like you have a bigger role this year on Philly than you did last year. Your scoring's up, your assists are up, but your turnovers are up. And I said to him, I'm not going to say his name. I was like, Bob. I said, Bob, there's a thing called turnover percentage. So as your usage rate rises, right, you use more possessions. So if my turnovers tick up a little bit because I'm using more possessions, guess what? My turnovers actually haven't gone up because I'm using more possessions. Very simple stat. Easy to look up. It's on NBA.com. We all have access to it. It's free. My turnovers are not up. My usage is up. Big difference. Right? Small example, didn't get used in the article. We're using stuff like that every day in the media.
Yeah.
It paints the wrong picture. And on the flip side of that, this is the really tough part. That's what gets engagement. And so that feeds the cycle, and it's just feeds on itself. And you have the people that do it, and then you have the people on the other side who are like, I watch film. We just hired two people, these guys, Nikias and Steve. They consume basketball all day long. They probably know more about Denver's defense. They absolutely do. They know more about Denver's defensive schemes than I do. And I've watched Denver play 20 to 25 times this year, which is a lot given that I have to cover all 30 teams.
Yeah.
People like them, they've got the better content. But for some reason, we're focused over here on people being disingenuous, uneducated. And it's frustrating. By the way, I'm not talking about Stephen A. This is not me Stephen A. I'm talking about what happens. Stephen A, I love. And today you used an advanced stat on First Take, and I acknowledged it, come a long way. But this is what the media is now. And it's not fair to the players. It's not fair to the fans. And so now everybody's just angry at each other.
Let's move to media. I want to hear a little bit about Old Man, because Old Man and the Three, you guys have absolutely crushed it.
Thank you.
Hank and I are podcast rookies, and we don't know what we're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, one of the reasons why we were very intrigued to have you as a guest, other than the fact you had an incredible basketball career, you're killing it as a podcaster. So obviously, we're just starting up here, like Jay said, and we're kind of clueless. So, you know, you guys have millions of downloads. I feel like the podcast game has changed a lot over the years. Has your approach changed at all since you started during your career, actually, as the first player, right?
That's actually a good question. Yeah, I started in 2016, so I started a little over 7 years ago. I took about a year off right after that first year because my son was born in August of 16, so I sort of finished out my first year of my contract, and then season was just getting going, and I didn't feel like I could do a two-year-old, a two-month-old, be on the road all the time, do all the stuff I needed. Basketball was always a priority, right? And then, like, I'm asking my wife to then let me do a podcast on the side. Like, it was like, no, if you're home, motherfucker, you're with the kids. You know what I mean? So I was like, all right, I'm going to, you know. So then I restarted in the fall of 17. So I took about a year off and been doing it consistently for the last 6 years. The Old Man of the Three, we've done weekly now for almost 3 years. The approach hasn't changed. I think the market saturation is where I sort of had an advantage initially because I was the first active NBA guy to do one. And so there was a little bit of a novelty to it. I'm not even sure if I was any good at it back then. I just was like very curious and I liked having these conversations. And so the timing of the first podcast, I think, benefited me. And then COVID, when we realized you could Zoom, right? I didn't know Zoom was a thing because we were only recording in person when I was doing it with the Ringer. We realized, oh, you can do it over Zoom. We can be remote now. We can actually put out content more consistently. And then it sort of light bulb went off. I was like, let's go Tommy and I were like, let's go do our own thing. Own all the IP, own the RSS feed. So I've actually changed RSS feeds 3 times, lost IP 3 times. So this is like our thing now. The approach now, I think, to fully answer your question, the approach now is just be consistent. And that's the advice I give anyone who asks me about podcasting in general or getting into the podcast or why am I not getting views? And it's like, well, I went through the same thing for 4 years, basically. If you're not doing it consistently and your audience doesn't know when the next thing is going to drop, it's really hard to build that audience. And so I didn't realize this till probably 3 years ago. My only concern, I don't care about ad sales. I don't care about campaigns. I don't. I let somebody else handle all of that. I don't care what the downloads are. I literally don't care. I just care about the audience and growing the audience. And that is the approach. Grow the audience, guess what? The downloads go up. The views on YouTube go up. Like, so doing things that grow an audience, that connects with people, that's it.
So you talk about the audience. When you do a prep for a show, you have great guests on, by the way, and when you sit there and plan questions, because I think about that all the time when I have guests on here with me and Jay, we sit down. Do you think about what you want to know or what you think the listeners want to know?
Oh, that's interesting. I think about both. And I think Tommy does a great job of thinking about what the listeners want to know. And a lot of his questions sort of go down that lane. So if there's a player who had, let's say, a viral moment and telling the backstory of that viral moment, that's really interesting to a lot of listeners. I could probably guess, you know, certain things I'll ask, but like I can guess kind of the meaning behind it or the backstory. It's not as important to me. What is important to me is what's very specific to that player. And oftentimes it's what's specific to that player and how that fits in the context of larger conversations around the NBA. The Dame thing is really interesting. Damian Lillard, I've had 3 conversations on my podcast that legit left like an impact on me, like an impression, like, ooh, I'm rethinking about things. The first time we had DeMar DeRozan on, Dame's episode, and then most recently J.R. Smith, because him and I are going through the same thing right now. We're just recently retired, trying to figure out like, how do I find something that gave me the same sort of thrill as that? But the Dame thing was great, and it was about just what we just talked about and the media wanting something for you and you trying to just enjoy, I'm in this lane, I'm trying to enjoy it, I'm in the NBA, why can't I just enjoy this? And everybody wants me to do this thing. And he said, I never forget it, is the greatest line ever on our podcast. I said to him, how are you so unbothered? How do you just like stay calm and peaceful amidst all the noise? And he goes, it's because I have a life. And I was like, that's a bar right there. Yeah. Like, I was like, all right.
But when you started, what was this goal? Is this what you envisioned? Or is there another level to it? Or have you arrived to where you want to be with it?
No to that question. I have not arrived. Never feel like I have. I always feel like there's more. I always feel like you can improve, you can evolve, you can adapt. I had to do it as a player. Whatever I do for the next 30 years, I'm going to take the same approach. I never was like, so a lot of people think because I started a podcast while I was a player, oh, you're doing getting reps to do media post-career. I thought I was going to go get my MBA and work on Wall Street. Like, I always thought that for the last 10 years, that's what I thought I was going to do. So I kind of just fell into this, honestly. The podcast was born out of, we've talked about this word, curiosity. It was just born out of curiosity. I like asking people questions. I know I talk a lot on your podcast, but I like to talk, you know, ask a question and just like listen. I think guests come on, you learn something. And I feel like that's the enjoyment of the podcast itself. The other best part, and I say this, it's like the goal for everyone that comes on the show. Some people, you don't have to worry about this. Like, everybody loves Steph. My goal for Steph was like, I don't want people to love Steph. They already do. But for some guys, it's like, I love this guy. Maybe they don't know enough about him. Maybe he's misunderstood. Like, how can we get people to love this guy in the way that I love the guy? If I can bring out the things I love about this player or this person, because a lot of times it is a personal relationship, like that becomes a goal too.
You have players reaching out begging to be on the show?
I wouldn't
That's
say.
A serious question, by the way.
I wouldn't say, no, not begging, not begging. We get, look, this is the hard part about the podcast. I'm uncomfortable asking people for things, right?
Yeah, sure.
And typically I don't do the ask. If it's a big ask, I'll have to do it. But we get players that request to be on the show. We get agents that email, can so-and-so be on? We're trying to make a push for defensive player of the year. Can so-and-so be on? We're trying to make a push for all-star or whatever. You know, they it's almost like a promo thing. Or we get requests, you know, sometimes from like movie studios that are like, can we put, because we did that initially, we had a lot of non-basketball players on. And so we would get like, so-and-so's got a movie coming out, so-and-so's got a book out. Can you put them on the show as like the promo thing? So we do get requests, but nobody's ever begged.
You work TV, ESPN, and you do the pod. Do you feel more free on the podcast, or is it the same focus sitting here as sitting ESPN studio?
I have so many different jobs. That's the reality. So the podcast is like a job, and now we do two a week. One is just basketball specific content where we talk about three things that's happening in the NBA. A lot of it is stat driven, not a lot of like, it's not takey, if that makes sense. It's just like, here's what's happening, here's our reaction to it. Then we have the interview show. So I have like my approach there. First Take is a different approach. I also call games for ESPN. That is different than anything else I do. I also have a partnership with DraftKings. So that's a whole nother approach, right? And so you're constantly balancing this. Literally yesterday, it's a great question, because literally yesterday I was scratching my head because we had just finished with Trey Murphy, who plays for the Pelicans. We just finished our interview with him. And I was thinking about First Take. And then I was like, I might have a game Friday. And I'm like, my brain feels warped right now because you do have to look at each of these things differently. And sometimes they like overlap a little bit. And you're like, I would have done that differently here. I should have saved that for that.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. I was in one last weekend. There's a lot right now with the playoffs going on, and we have the pod here and MSG Networks, TNT, and there were so many games going on. And during the regular season, it's just one game, but during the playoffs, I feel like there's so much action. So my head was just spinning. And I remember one of the guys asked me a question, and it was almost like I couldn't answer. I could hear myself think, but I'm like, say something.
Yeah.
Just say something. But,
well, that's a good question. Like, how do you guys stay present? I know what your calendar looks like. I see you, you know, all the time on, you know, all these different channels. How do you stay present? How do you like give the love and respect to your friends and family that they need?
I look at every week and day as just like, that's what I have to do today. So what is my free hour? I committed to coaching my kid. I do that 4 days a week. That's another commitment on top of that. It's harder to find the me time. And so when I do like Friday, if I don't get a game, if all, you know, one of the teams loses tonight, there's no games, you know, six on Friday, I won't have a game. Like I have nothing to do Friday. It's like those days are few and far between. So when my kids are at school, I'm going to go find something to do. And that's exciting. I have a question for you. Actually two. First of all, how are you finding media and sort of the post playing career?
How I find it?
Yeah. How do you find it? Like, and I guess the follow up to that is because the reason I ask is because I'm enjoying the hell out of it, but maybe because it's this time of year, it's the playoffs. I've gotten so nostalgic. I cried. I took my kids to game four, the Nets Sixers. I cried during the national anthem because I was just like, fuck, man, I miss this so much. I miss the feeling.
Yeah.
You know, I miss the competition. And this is great. It's great.
Yeah.
But there's no drug like that.
No, I you know what? During the regular season, it's pretty, I'm not going to say easy, but I can distance myself to the sport. But going into the playoffs, I'm with you. Like the intensity goes up, the emotions, and you remember how you felt going out to the game and the expectations, the pressure. Yeah, I definitely miss that. And when it comes to media, you know, I'm having a lot of fun with doing all these different things but for me, it's about the right amount of time spending on it. It will never come close to the passion, you know, I have for hockey. And I'm not going to try to replace that. I understand that I played hockey for over 30 years in my life. And it gave me a reason to, I'm not going to say go get up in the morning, but it really guided me throughout life. Hockey did. Made so many decisions for me, and now I just have to kind of start over and try to find these things to kind of guide me for the next chapter. Right now, just trying different things. Media's been one thing,
yeah.
But part of me feels kind of comfortable with it because being a professional athlete is kind of part of your, you know, part of your life, anyways. And I have a lot of friends working in the media industry, so it's nice to hang with them and enjoy the time together.
I think what you said about the reason to get up in the morning is it's not hyperbolic because I did feel like part of it was like it gave me a purpose, right? And I think that was the tough part at Duke, and it was still is to a degree the tough part about retiring is when something is your purpose, it becomes your identity and it becomes a part of your ego structure. And then every athlete, you know, not to be morbid, but every athlete has to die twice, right? There's the retirement, you die. Like a part of you dies.
Yeah.
And letting go of that, oh, it's hard, man. It was hard. I knew it was the right thing, but it was hard.
Despite the fact that a part of you guys have both died. And
I'm still here.
Yeah, R.I.P. No. You guys have a lot to contribute to the world. And like, what does that look like? You know, you strike me as a very detail-oriented, you're a student of the game. And where do you build that? And where do you put that for the next 5-10 years?
Talk about purpose. First purpose and first priority is raising two kids. Like, and not just raising them and like being a parent, but like making sure that they are kind and empathetic and thoughtful and inclusive. All of the things that I learned how to be. My parents were all those things, but you have to learn for yourself. I learned that honestly through basketball. And so I want to be very active in their lives. And then, you know, I talked about this like obsession with basketball and the obsession with the game. I think it's about being a steward for the game. I think that's a priority, being a steward. I don't know what that looks like. It could be being in sports media for a while. It could be coaching. That would certainly scratch a little competitive itch. You know what I mean? And then the third thing is golf. You know?
You love golf.
Oh, I love golf.
What is it about golf that you love so much?
Well, it's my me time. It's my happy place. No. I spent 30 years in a gym, a bus, a hotel room, an airplane, a locker room, being outside for 4.5 hours. That is maybe number one. Number two is just the challenge of it, right? The idea of arriving, you could never arrive in golf. There's always an improvement to be made. I have a lot of improvements to be made. It's just like pursuit of self-improvement. And then it does, honestly, it does scratch the competitive itch. I don't play for like big money. I'm not like gambling for $50,000 a match or $5,000 a hole or anything crazy like that. But like you do a Nassau closeout and you bet on the front, bet on the back, bet on the match, and you have automatic presses and you're like, yeah, okay, I got some action today. That was fun. That was competitive.
I'm struggling with golf just to decide if I should play or not. I did play. Like 20 years ago, I started playing golf. I played for 7-8 years. But it came to a point where I realized I spent 4.5 hours. I come home really pissed off. And there was one moment that was deciding for me. And I was hitting a drive, sliced, always sliced. That is a huge problem for me. I would go back to the bag, and I hit the bag so hard that I snapped the club in two. Next hole, I pick up the spoon. That snapped in half. A hole later, I pick up the wedge. It snapped in half. It really, so I destroyed three clubs
in one swing.
To that, I used to throw clubs into the woods and forget about them. And then I needed that club two holes later. So I realized I'm too competitive to play this sport until I'm more consistent.
Well, yeah, that's the problem is when you join as a latecomer and there's a skill differential between your hockey friends who you're as good as, or your hoops friends who you're as good as on the court, and then you have like such a discrepancy on the golf course. I couldn't stand it. Like I'm used to beating these guys at everything, and this fat nerd is just working me on the golf course. I can't do it.
No, but I agree with you, JJ, just to come out, and that's why I want to love it. And right now I'm playing once a year. It's like a charity golf. That's it.
Yeah, right.
But
right.
I eventually will pick it up. But just
I feel like hockey and baseball guys, for generations, you guys have played golf. And Jordan made it cool. So when I first got in the league, everybody played golf. Like, not everybody, but a lot of guys on my team played golf. And then I had like a 10-year stretch where nobody golfed. And then I think Steph made it cool again. I really do. Yeah. J.R. Smith made it cool again. Iggy made it cool again. So now golf is now a thing again in the NBA, which is awesome. But I wasted legitimately years of my life in the NBA not playing golf, and I regret it because I got serious about it when I was 36, and it's can't do that. You know, I got a long way to go.
Well, the best part, you can play for the next
30 years,
yeah. Right? So you're good.
Hank plays on the other side of the country, called on the tennis courts. So
you play tennis?
Yeah, tennis is my sport.
I'm glad you found some.
Aw, that's so nice.
It's all about finding something, right? Listen, I know you have to go and coach your kid. You don't want to be late for that, but we really appreciate you coming on here and talking to us about your career and podcasting. And me and Jay, we're going to listen to this 10 times now so we can improve our podcast.
No doubt. Tell Tommy to call me.
I would tips, yeah, please. Me and Jay, we have to plan a trip to Brooklyn.
Obviously, yeah. Bring your passport, Hank.
I will.
You know that there's like better restaurants in Brooklyn than there are in Manhattan. You know that, right?
I believe it when I see it.
Okay. Yeah. I'm just telling you.
Don't have to
call. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, thanks, man.
That was awesome. Thank you so much.
Thanks, JJ.
That was a good sit down with JJ Redick, rushing out of here to coach his kid in basketball. But it was great. A lot to learn about podcasting, and it's interesting to hear his story and how it developed, you know, a little project to now millions of downloads. And he's a smart guy, no question about it.
Yeah, if you like what you hear, we would love to have you as members of Club 30. So please like, subscribe, give us a rating. Could be 1 star, could be 5. It's okay.
Hopefully five.
Have a good week, guys.
See ya.